This morning we had a very deep and interesting discussion from Brother Bill on the sacraments and baptism, and it looks like we have another intriguing discussion. The title of Brother Bill Ducca's talk is You Are What You Believe, and there is a handout. So if the deacons can help with that.
Good afternoon. We'd like to thank the Chicago Ecclesia for their warm hospitality while we stayed here, and especially Brother and Sister Kalinske, with whom we stayed with. We had some wonderful fellowship. We have a handout that reflects some of our thoughts that we will be presenting this afternoon. It'll be a couple of minutes before we catch up to the handout. So till then, please lay the handout aside until we lay some groundwork for our direction, our paradigm shift, to focus our minds on the subject. How many here would agree with the statement that you are what you believe? Hopefully we have everybody's hand raised. Sometimes it is hard to relate our everyday activities with our Christianity. Those who are still employed in the workforce have a daily routine, and our interaction with others does not always lend itself to the opportunity of us witnessing that we are Christians. Others that are retired have a daily routine of service that has become a part of their life. And the younger you are as a Christian, the more growth or development you might observe, just because of the contrast. This doesn't mean that a full-grown Christian or a full-grown tree stops developing. We live in a more refined society today, where honesty and integrity are expected, and people try to behave themselves and act accordingly. Thus, we go through our daily activities, and we act cordial, even if principles are tested. Our reaction to the situation could be so natural that we don't even see that our reaction could have been something out of the ordinary. Even if other people take notice that a reaction was odd, it doesn't always send out a signal that you are a Christian, for many people are not familiar with real Christian principles. One might think that you could just be a good person, good, honest person, with a high moral standard. We are going to look at an example that if our conscience is rightly exercised, it will show that we have the proper focus. Thus, one's actions dictate their resolve. So then, you are what you believe. The question then is, how do you form ideas and opinions? What is your main influence that is directing your thought? Of course, we all know the answer to this question is the Word of God. As Martin Luther said on April 18th in the year 1521 at 6 p.m., my conscience is captive to God's Word, and it is neither safe nor right to go against conscience. The Scriptures are what educate our conscience, thus dictating our actions. But not just the Scriptures, but the proper interpretation of the Scriptures. So in essence, these principles shape our character, how we think, and how we act. Having or not having the proper perspective on a subject can alter the way you view it. So then, you are what you believe to be true and know. 15th century Europeans knew that the sky was made of close concentric crystal spheres rotating around a central earth and carrying the stars and the planets. That belief of knowledge structured everything they did and thought because it told them the truth. Then, Galileo's telescope changed the truth. As a result, 100 years later, everyone knew that the universe was open and infinite, working like a giant clock. architecture, music, literature, science, economics, politics, everything changed, mirroring the new view created by the change in the knowledge. Today, we live according to the latest version of how the universe functions. This view affects our behavior and thought just as previous versions affected those who lived with them. Like the people of the past, we disregard phenomena which do not fit our view because they are wrong or outdated. Like our ancestors, we know the real truth. At any time in the past, people have held a view of the way the universe works which was for them similarly definitive, whether it was based on myth or research. And at any time, that view they held was sooner or later altered by a change in the body of knowledge. Let's examine one of these present-day views in order to show that what you believe influences your behavior. We want to go back to the account of Noah right after the flood. What we know from the account of the flood is that only 8 people survived the deluge. This was Noah, his 3 sons, and all their wives, a total of 8. Then the story picks up in Genesis, the 9th chapter, with the genealogy of Noah's prodigy. So let's turn to Genesis, the 9th chapter, and read verses 18 through 29, Noah and his sons. Genesis 9, verse 18. The sons of Noah who went out of the ark were Shem, Ham, and Japheth, and Ham was the father of Canaan. These 3 were the sons of Noah, and from these the whole earth was peopled or repopulated. Noah, a man of the soil, was the first to plant a vineyard. He drank some of the wine and became drunk, and he lay uncovered in his tent. And Ham, the father of Canaan, saw the nakedness of his father and told his 2 brothers outside. Then Shem and Japheth took a garment, laid it on both of their shoulders, and walked backward and covered the nakedness of their father. Their faces were turned away, and they did not see their father's nakedness. When Noah woke from his wine and knew what his youngest son had done unto him, he said, "Cursed be Canaan. Lowest of slaves shall he be to his brothers." He also said, "Blessed by the Lord my God be Shem, and let Canaan be his slave. May God make space for Japheth, and let him live in the tents of Shem, and let Canaan be his slave." After the flood, Noah lived 350 years. All the days of Noah were 950 years, and he died. The question then is, from the account in verse 25, why is Canaan cursed? The answer to this question is in verse 22. And Ham, the father of Canaan, saw the nakedness of his father. We want to focus more on the question, what was this curse that was pronounced on Canaan? What was the curse that was pronounced on Canaan? The answer to this question is directly related to how you think and act. There have been many answers given to this question throughout history. Let's take a look at history from the vantage point where we stand today and see what conclusions we can draw. The curse that was pronounced on Canaan, in verse 25, he said, "Cursed be Canaan, lowest of slaves shall he be to his brothers." To help us answer this question, let's ask, who are Canaan's brothers? Are they the natural brothers of their father Ham, or brethren, Canaan's uncles, Japheth and Shem? In verse 26 and 27, seems to have the thought that his brothers are his uncles Shem and Japheth. The word brethren is Strong's 251. It is used in the sense of family or relatives, and it does not discriminate one over the other. We will look at historical evidence for our determination. What kind of slave was Canaan unto his brethren? How long was Canaan a servant of his brethren, and how was he a servant? First, let's see what Vine's Expository Dictionary of Biblical Words has to say about the definition of 5650, to serve or servant. This noun appears over 750 times in the Old Testament. It first appears in Genesis 9:25, "A servant of servants shall he, Canaan, be unto his brethren," meaning the lowest of slaves. A servant may be bought with money, as in Exodus 12, verse 44, or hired, as in 1 Kings 5, verse 6. And then the often repeated statement of God's redemption of Israel, "who brought you out of the land of Egypt and redeemed you from the house of slavery," Deuteronomy 13, verse 5. Slavery is the mark of those called by God, as in Exodus 14, verse 31. They believed the Lord and his servant Moses. Then God claimed, "For unto me the children of Israel are servants," as in Leviticus 25, verse 55, and Isaiah 49, verse 3. And the Lord spoke by his servant the prophets, as in 2 Kings 21, verse 10. Then the psalmist said, in Psalms 116, verse 16, "I am thy servant," indicating the appropriateness of this title to all believers. The word servant in vines does not encompass the harsh treatment that we have associated with slavery during the 19th century. This is because the Word of God does not teach being inhumane to your fellow man. In fact, when God gave man dominion, it was over the lower creation and not over each other. To use the word inhumane is an understatement in the context of slavery during the 19th century. The scriptural period for slavery was limited to 6 years, as in Exodus 21, verse 2. And slaves had rights and protection under the law, as in Exodus 21, verse 20. The phrase, "the servant of the Lord," is one of the most outstanding references to the Messiah in the Old Testament, and its teachings are concentrated at the end of the book of Isaiah. "Therefore, a slave is one who is bound in servitude as the property of another person." Let's look at some thoughts of the past and see how verses 25 and 26 in Genesis, the 9th chapter, have been interpreted. Let's read once more Genesis 9, 25 and 26. "He said, 'Cursed be Canaan, lowest of slaves shall he be to his brothers.' He also said, 'Blessed by the Lord my God be Shem, and let Canaan be his slave.'" The interpretation of many would be that the curse here consists of being in servitude of an inferior position of the most abject kind. This imposed inferiority of the self-willed slave owners tends more and more to all the horrid ills of slavery, man's inhumanity to man. The slavery we know originated in war and conquest. The mere warrior put the captives to death. The cannibal devoured them. The economist fed them for their labor. Accordingly, slavery soon made its appearance in all countries which were trodden by the conqueror. A system of slavery imposed without consent and for no crime is a dire evil. Besides the direct injustice of robbing a fellow man of his personal liberty, it dissolves wedlock, breaks the family tie, and disregards, most importantly, the conscience. It trades, therefore, in the souls of mankind. It is a historical fact that the degradation of slavery has fallen especially upon the race of Ham. As we look at history, we can see that a portion of the Canaanites were bondsmen among the Israelites, who were of the race of Shem. The early Babylonians, the Phoenicians, the Carthaginians, and the Egyptians, who all belonged to the race of Ham, were subjugated by the Assyrians, who were Shemites. Then we have the Persians, the Macedonians, and the Romans, who were all Japhethites, who traded in slaves. In modern times, it is well known that most of the nations of Europe traded in African slaves. It has been said that the servile tribe is also the most tyrannical. And of course, without a demand, you would not have a market. As we look at history, this curse pronounced by Noah on Canaan was man's justification for slavery of the most degraded kind that man has experienced, and justified by those who traded in it because of their interpretation of these verses and of their self-will. Just a side note, Denmark was the first European country to abolish the slave trade in the year 1792. England's Parliament abolished West Indian slave trade in 1833 and slavery in Jamaica in 1838. And on January 1st, 1863, Abraham Lincoln declared that all slaves within any state or designated part of a state then in rebellion shall be then, thenceforward, and forever free. And it wasn't until 1865 that slavery was abolished in the United States. Interesting to note that when we were in Ghana, we visited the Cape Coast Castle that exported slaves. And it was interesting to note from their literature that the Cape Coast Castle stopped the slave trade in the year 1874. Is this what Noah had in mind when he pronounced this curse? What kind of man was Noah? Better yet, what did God think of Noah? Let's read Genesis 6, 8 and 9. Genesis 6, verse 8. But Noah found favor in the sight of the Lord. These are the descendants of Noah. Noah was a righteous man, blameless in his generations. Noah walked with God. From vines, we get the thought that Noah was a righteous or just man. In the sense of loyalty to God, he would have been in harmony with God and his plans and purposes as far as his understanding would have permitted, and would not have done anything out of harmony or displeasing to the Creator. Noah was a patriarch. This is testified in him being selected to build the ark in Genesis, the 6th chapter, verses 14 through 22. Genesis 6, 14 through 22. We're going to read Genesis 6, 14 and 22. Genesis 6, 14. Make yourself an ark of cypress wood. Make rooms in the ark and cover it inside and outside with pitch. Verse 22. Noah did this. He did all that God commanded him. So then, how was this curse executed on Canaan? We know from Genesis 9, verse 19, that the earth was populated from these eight. Let's read once more Genesis 9, 19 from the Amplified. These are the three sons of Noah, and from them the whole earth was overspread and stocked with inhabitants. Let's take a moment to look at the descendants of Noah's sons. The three distinct ethnic groups that came from Noah's sons are Shem, the Semitic people, including the Hebrews, Ham, the Hamitic tribe, and Japheth historically was the progenitor of the Aryan or Indo-European, Indo-Germanic branch of the human family. This prophecy or curse pronounced on Canaan by Noah is fulfilled in that the Canaanite was always dominated by either one of his two brethren, his uncles, the Shemite or the Japhethite. A portion of the Canaanites became bondsmen among the Israelites, who were of the race of Shem. The early Babylonians, the Phoenicians, the Carthaginians, the Egyptians, who all belonged to the race of Ham, were subjugated by the Assyrians, who were Shemites. In Deuteronomy 32, verse 49, we see an example of how the Semitic people, or the Hebrews in particular, had the race of the Canaanites subjected to them. Let's read Deuteronomy 32:49. Deuteronomy 32:49. Ascend this mountain of the Abram, Mount Nebo, which is in the land of Moab, across from Jericho, and view the land of Canaan, which I am giving to the Israelites for a possession. When God gives something to you or takes something away from you, and gives it to another, you don't question the wisdom of the Creator, although you might not understand His plans and purposes at the time. The Canaanites became subservient to the Shemites. From Shem came Abraham, and from Abraham, ultimately, the 12 tribes of Israel, who were given the land of Canaan, as we read in Deuteronomy 32, verse 49. Behold the land of Canaan, which I give unto the children of Israel for a possession. Let's look at another question that seems to have perplexed skeptics as well as believers. How were the races created? We know that in Adam, God had incorporated the entire human gene pool. The Apostle Paul, on a sermon on Mars Hill before the Areopagus, states in Acts 17:26, from one ancestor, he made all nations to inhabit the whole earth, and he allotted the times of their existence and the boundaries of the places where they would live. Once again, through Noah and his wives and his sons and their wives, the entire gene pool of all the nations existed of a pure Adamic stock. The question is then, how did the variety of races come into existence? We believe that in the confounding of the languages during the building of the Tower of Babel, God not only separated the human race by languages, but by dominant genes. In God's design, He separated the races by languages and gene pool at the same time. He paired up the dominant genes with the same languages to create the different races, thus separating the people outwardly by language and inwardly to the unknowing couples by dominant genes to produce His desired result. Let's read Genesis, the 11th chapter, verses 1 through 9, the Tower of Babel. Genesis 11, verse 1. Now the whole earth had one language and the same words. And as they migrated from the east, they came upon the plain in the land of Shinar and settled there. And they said one to another, come, let us make bricks and burn them thoroughly. And they had bricks for stone and bitumen for mortar. Then they said, come, let us build ourselves a city and a tower with its top into the heavens. And let us make a name for ourselves. Otherwise we shall be scattered abroad upon the face of the whole earth. Then verse 5. The Lord came down to see the city and the tower which mortals had built. And the Lord said, look, they are one people, and they have all one language, and this is only the beginning of what they will do. Nothing that they propose to do will now be impossible for them. Come, let us go down and confound their language there, so that they will not understand one another's speech. So the Lord scattered them abroad from there over the face of all the earth, and they left off building the city. Therefore it was called Babel, because there the Lord confused the language of all the earth, and from there the Lord scattered them abroad over the face of all the earth. How many can remember high school biology and Mendel's law? Gregor Mendel was an Austrian monk who published his works on the patterns of inheritance in different pea plant varieties in 1866. The science of genetics began in 1900 when several plant breeders independently discovered his works. Mendel suggested that each parent has pairs of these units, but contributes only one unit from each pair to its offspring. These units were later given the name genes. God destroyed the Tower of Babel to confuse the tongues, to separate the people. In addition to separating the people into nations, He separated them into races. Today we have approximately 5,000 languages, 50 to 200 unrelated stocks that trace back to about 2500 BC, roughly the time of the Tower of Babel. Biologists who predict the distribution of genetic information use the Punnett Square. With divine wisdom and intervention, within two generations, you can have all the races from the blackest black to the whitest white. And if you were to let all the races intermarry for a length of time, you would eventually end up with one race, like an Adam, because of the dominant genes. This would be the same race that was dispersed with the confounding of the languages. This is also the direction that the U.S. demographics are headed, one big melting pot. Let's read Genesis 9, verse 23. Then Shem and Japheth took a garment and laid it on both of their shoulders and walked backward and covered the nakedness of their father. Their faces were turned away and they did not see their father's nakedness. Shem and Japheth, out of respect, took a garment and, not looking, covered their father's nakedness. In Genesis 9:26, how is blessed by the Lord my God be Shem fulfilled? This means that in a particular sense, God would be identified as the God of Shem, through whom the Messiah would come for human redemption. This is the prophetic designation of Shem as the patriarch through whom Jesus would be born. Let's look at Genesis 9, verse 27. What is meant by "may God make space for Japheth and let him live in the tents of Shem"? Let us read a couple different translations here. From the King James, Genesis 9, verse 27, God shall enlarge Japheth. Then the New Revised Standard Version, may God make space for Japheth. Then we have the NAS, may God enlarge Japheth. And the NIV, may God extend the territory of Japheth. May God extend the territory of Japheth. This is prophesied in the multiplication of his posterity, which was remarkably fulfilled in the prolification of the populations of Europe and other places where the so-called Western civilization prevailed. What is meant in verse 27, and let him live in the tents of Shem? Depending on the word "him" in this passage, it either refers to God or to Japheth. Two various interpretations have been proposed. The humorous view is that the Caucasians shall live in the tents of Shem is said to be fulfilled, and that most of the Japhethites pay rent to Jewish landlords. We don't think that is what this text is referring to. In fact, this kind of interpretation leads to what we first discussed about man's ideas about slavery. It leads to division, and it leads to prejudice. We think that he here refers to God and not to Japheth. He, God, shall dwell in the tents of Shem, another reference to the spiritual blessings upon Israel through who the messianic line, the participation of the Japhethites in the sharing of the blessings of the Shemites, was exclusively started out to be God's dealings with the Jews, ended up that the Gentiles are grafted in, and eventually all the families of the earth will receive God's blessings. Many changes were brought about by the flood. In Genesis 9, verse 2, tells us of the first time that animals feared man. In Genesis 9, verse 3, that animals could now be killed for meat. And in Genesis 9, verse 21, we are informed that food and drink would spoil. Noah had not expected this. Let's read Genesis 9, verses 1 through 3. Genesis 9, 1. God blessed Noah and his sons and said to them, "Be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth. The fear and dread of you shall rest on every animal of the earth, and on every bird of the air, on everything that creepeth on the ground, and on all the fish of the sea. Into your hand they are delivered." Every moving thing that lives shall be food for you. And just as I have given the green plant, I give you everything. Let us make a suggestion here that Noah, not expecting the change that occurred to cause fermentation of fruit juice, became intoxicated and fell asleep. In conclusion, you are what you believe. We are going to look at three aspects of the kingdom that deal with the Canaanite in our conclusion here. One, we're going to look at Zechariah, the 14th chapter, verse 21. Then we're going to look at, secondly, the Canaanite as a tradesman or a merchant. And thirdly, why the Canaanite was restricted from entering the house of the Lord. Let's look at Zechariah, the 14th chapter, verses 16 and 21. Zechariah 14, verse 16. Then it will come about that any who are left of all the nations that went against Jerusalem will go up from year to year to worship the King, the Lord of hosts, and to celebrate the Feast of Booths. Or as it says in the NIV, the Feast of Tabernacles. Then skipping down to verse 21. And every cooking pot in Jerusalem and in Judea will be holy to the Lord of hosts. And all who sacrifice will come and take of them and boil in them. And there will no longer be a Canaanite in the house of the Lord of hosts in that day. The Feast of Tabernacles followed closely the Day of Atonement. Both took place in the seventh month, one on the 10th and the other on the 15th of Tishri. What the seventh day or Sabbath was in reference to the week, the seventh month seems to have been in reference to the year. It closed not only the sacred cycle, but also the agricultural or working year. It also marked the change of seasons, the approach of rain, and the winter equinox, and determined alike the commencement and close of the sabbatical year. This, the Feast of Tabernacles, followed 5 days after the Day of Atonement, in which the sins of Israel had been removed and its covenant relation to God restored. Thus a sanctified nation could keep holy a Feast of Harvest, joy unto the Lord, just as in the truest sense it will be in that day when the meaning of the Feast of Tabernacles shall be a reality fulfilled. Notice in the reading of Deuteronomy 16, 13 through 17, the Festival of Booths is reviewed. There are three specially marked events of the Festival of Tabernacles: its joyous festivals, the dwelling in booths, and the sacrifices and rites of the week. The first of these was simply characteristic of the Feast of Ingathering. States, nor were any in Israel to appear before the Lord empty. Let's read Deuteronomy 16, 13 through 17, the Festival of Booths reviewed. Deuteronomy 16, verse 13. You shall keep the Festival of Booths for 7 days, when you have gathered in the produce from your threshing floor and from your winepress. Rejoice during your festival, you and your sons and your daughters, your male and your female slaves, as well as the Levites, the strangers, the orphans, and the widows resident in your land. 7 days you shall keep the festival of the Lord your God at the place that the Lord will choose, for the Lord your God will bless you in all your produce and in all your undertakings, and you shall surely celebrate. 3 times a year your males shall appear before the Lord your God at the place that he will choose, at the festival of unleavened bread, at the festival of weeks, and at the festival of booths. They shall not appear before the Lord empty-handed. All shall give as they are able, according to the blessings of the Lord your God that he has given you. The Feast of Tabernacles represents the millennial age. What is meant in verse 21 of Genesis 9, and there will no longer be a Canaanite. That's not Genesis. In Zechariah. Zechariah verse 21, and there will no longer be a Canaanite in the house of the Lord of hosts in that day. The Canaanite people were idolatrous and immoral people. So then, by not having any more Canaanite around would represent total fidelity to God. Man will, in the millennial age, purge himself of all impurities of thought, thus making his actions perfect and in accordance with how God intended man to be from the beginning, perfect with experience. Thus the created will be able to worship the Creator with full knowledge of his actions. The Canaanite was also known as a tradesman or a merchant. Let's read a number of these verses and we can reflect on them as we read. Ezekiel, the 27th chapter, verse 36, the lamentation over Tyre. Ezekiel 27:36. The merchants among the people hiss at you. You have come to a dreadful end and shall be no more forever. Then we have the verse in Isaiah, the 23rd chapter, verse 8, an oracle concerning Tyre. Isaiah 23, verse 8. Who has planned this against Tyre, the bestower of crowns, whose merchants were princes, whose traders were the honored of the earth? Then we have Isaiah, the 47th chapter, verse 15, the humiliation of Babylon. Isaiah 47, verse 15. Such to you are those with whom you have labored, who have merchant or trafficked with you from your youth. They are all wander about in their own paths. There is no one to save you. Then we have those familiar verses in Revelation 18. Revelation 18, verse 3, the fall of Babylon. For all the nations have drunk of the wine of the wrath of her fornication, and the kings of the earth have committed fornication with her, and the merchants of the earth have grown rich from the power of her luxury. Then skipping down to verse 15 of Revelation 18, the merchants of these wars who gained wealth from her will stand far off in fear of her torment, weeping and mourning aloud. Then skipping a little further down to verse 23, we'll read this out of the Amplified. Revelation 18, verse 23. And never again shall the light of a lamp shine in you, and the voice of a bridegroom and a bride shall never be heard in you again. For your merchants or businessmen were the great and prominent men of the earth, and by your magic spells and poisonous charm, all nations were led astray, seduced and deluded. This is international in scope. England with its colonies all over the world and papacy. The Vatican State is a tiny plot of ground with great international power. Papacies claim to be the original church, the oldest church. Notice the mention of Tyre's antiquity in Isaiah, the 23rd chapter, verse 7 and 8. Isaiah 23, verse 7 and 8. Tyre was the crowning city. In Antipater, the popes crowned the kings of Europe, and Rome was the capital, the crowning city. The Holy Roman Empire, these are the salesmen of religious goods, popes, cardinals, archbishops, bishops, and all those alike. In the Old Testament, the command to destroy the Canaanite was very specific, and there is no ambiguity in these verses. Let's read Deuteronomy, the 7th chapter, verses 2 through 6, a chosen people. Deuteronomy chapter 7, verse 2. And when the Lord your God gives them over to you, and you defeat them, then you must utterly destroy them. Make no covenant with them, and show them no mercy. Do not intermarry with them, giving your daughters to their sons, or taking their daughters for your sons, for that would turn away your children from following me to serve other gods. Then the anger of the Lord would be kindled against you, and he would destroy you quickly. But this is how you must deal with them. Break down their altars, smash their pillars, hewn down their sacred poles, and burn their idols with fire. For you are a people holy to the Lord your God. The Lord your God has chosen you out of all the peoples of the earth to be his people, his treasured possession. But too often the house of David and the house of Judah built them high places and images and groves on every high hill and under every green tree. They did according to all the abominations of the nations which the Lord cast before them to the children of Israel. Thus the Canaanite became synonymous with religious and moral perversions of every kind. Again, reflecting on Zechariah 14, verse 21, Zechariah 14, 21, and in that day there shall be no more a Canaanite in the house of the Lord of hosts. A Canaanite was not permitted to enter the tabernacle or the temple. No longer would one of God's people who practiced the abominations of the Canaanites enter the house of the Lord. When we look at the scriptures that speak about the New Jerusalem, we notice that this is the kingdom for which we all pray for. This is a picture of peace on earth and all sin abolished. Let's read Revelation 21, 1 through 4, the new heaven and new earth. Revelation 21, 1 through 4. Then I saw a new heaven and a new earth. For the first heaven and the first earth had passed away, and the sea was no more. And I saw the holy city, the new Jerusalem, coming down out of heaven from God, prepared as a bride adorned for a husband. And I heard a loud voice from the throne saying, "See, the home of God is among mortals. He will dwell with them, and they will be his people. And God himself will be with them. He will wipe every tear from their eyes. Death will be no more. Mourning and crying and pain will be no more. For the first things have passed away." This is a picture of the kingdom on earth and that millennial mourning that we are all longing for. Let's finish or close with the reading of Revelation 22, verse 5, with a short comment. Revelation 22, verse 5. "And there will be no more night. They need no light of lamp or sun, for the Lord God will be their light, and they will reign forever and ever." This is in reference to those in the millennial age. The nature of the reign then will be delivered to the world. It will be the same reign or kingdom which at its creation was bestowed upon Father Adam, as it is written in Psalms 8, 6 through 8. And may the Lord add his blessing.